This season of the Peaches podcast is brought to you by our friends at Silverette. Now, many of you will know that this is a product that I have long sung the praises of. In fact, these little cups made up of antifungal, antimicrobial, healing, medical grade silver single-handedly saved my left nipple from early retirement when it came to breastfeeding. These are my go-to gift for any new mum. The Silverettes are simplistic genius. Little cups to protect and heal your nipples when you are in the trenches of learning how to breastfeed. Sore, oversensitive, cracked or even bleeding nips, no more. Guys, I have an exclusive discount for anyone wanting to give the new mum in their life the gift they will be thanking you for in years to come. 20% off using the code TORY20. Simply head to silverettaustralia.com. Now, this expires on the 30th of June, 2023, so you don't want to muck about. The link is in our show notes. Hi guys, and welcome back to the Peaches Potty. Now, this interview was actually my last big thing to achieve before having our next baby. In fact, this interview has been years in the making. Delia, you are the CEO at Domestic Violence New South Wales, and you are a woman who I have admired for so long. We first connected, I think it was about 2 years ago, and we started talking about doing a podcast interview. And since then, we've had a pandemic, we've had a couple of lockdowns, we've both birthed our first children. But today, we are sitting down to talk about a subject that I am most passionate about, and obviously you are too. And it's something that I believe that we need to turn the spotlight on even more. And that is men's violence against women. And I think we're all a little tired of some of the other terms like domestic violence or family violence. I'm kind of like, let's just fucking call it what it is. So we're just going for that today. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I know that this interview is going to be one that is felt deeply in the hearts of our Peaches community. And I know that you are a hell of a busy woman. Now, statistics tell me that one woman is murdered every single week in Australia at the hands of a man, and it's usually by someone known to her, like a partner or an ex-partner. And these numbers are terrifying. And sometimes I feel a little bit frustrated because I think to myself, if a human being was killed weekly in our country by any other mode, whether it was terrorism or a shark attack or a fucking faulty iPhone that explodes, you know, what when they're on the phone, like whatever it was, the country would be in uproar. People would not be okay. They'd be like, one human being is getting killed every week by this crazy situation and what are we doing about it? Yet still, we as a society seem to struggle to address this issue without wanting to bury our heads in the sand or change the subject or not bother those around us with heavy subjects of conversation. But I've kind of had enough of that bullshit, Delia, which is exactly why you're here with us today.
I am with you. I'm listening attentively and I am with you.
Thank you. I want to facilitate a conversation around it, and I particularly want to address the subject of coercive control. I think it's a great place for us to start when it comes to educating ourselves about domestic violence and understanding this slippery slope. So before we dive straight in, and I can ask you a zillion questions, could you tell us a little bit about you and your role?
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show. And I think this is a really important conversation to be having. Just as you said, you know, we're losing one woman a week. That is a human being. Let's stop pouring money into war, missiles, goodness knows what else, and then start thinking about this issue and addressing it. So thank you so much for having me on, Tori. So as everyone I'm sure knows, thank you for your introduction. I'm Delia Donovan. I'm a social worker by trade, inspired by my mum, funnily enough, who's also a social worker. Oh, wow. And Yeah, she's incredible. And actually, I initially worked in children's homes. They were called therapeutic communities, like out of home care in Australia. So I did a lot of work with children that were unable to live with their parents due to sexual abuse. So I've kind of worked at a really pointy end of social work, and then came over to Australia in 2015. And did a lot of work with White Ribbon, which was really interesting work because it was about mobilising and engaging the community in the prevention of men's violence against women. So really seeing things from a different angle in terms of community engagement, and left a role in the UK as a CEO of a frontline domestic violence organisation. And now I am the CEO of Domestic Violence New South Wales, the peak body that represents 150 services across this state. And I should say these are life-saving services. So I feel very, very proud of the work I do and the work I do with the team and the representation I have of those incredible services across our state of New South Wales.
Oh my gosh, you are an incredible woman. And guys, like, to those listening, I have to tell you that, like, finding a time to slot this interview in was crazy. Delia is one of the busiest women that I know. Her schedule, like, even looking at it gives me anxiety. The work that she does, as you've just heard, is so important. So we are so grateful to have you here with us today to talk to us. Can we start on something really basic, which is just defining coercive control for those listening? Like, let's start at the beginning and then start to dig a little deeper.
Sure. And I should also add, Tori, I think we're going to have some triggering conversations today, and I probably want to invite the listeners to think about 1-800-RESPECT if they need any support or help, or to go online to look at resources. And that number is 1-800-737-732. So now let's get into it. Coercive control. I'll speak about what coercive control looks like, but I do want to say, I think there's a real misunderstanding, you know, in terms of what coercive control is. And what we really need to understand is it is the underlying dynamic of domestic violence. It's the overarching context of domestic violence. And it looks like a pattern of behavior that a perpetrator will use to dominate and control another person. This could be through use of intimidation, threats, isolation, or manipulation. By the time you're, you know, a few years into a coercive controlling relationship, you won't even recognize yourself, and you'll feel like a hostage in your own home. You'll be gaslit, undermined. You'll feel a low self-esteem. It causes an incredible amount of harm to a person, and it's not initially obvious. I should also note that, you know, a recent report from the New South Wales coroner noted that in 99% of domestic violence homicides, coercive control was present. So it's hugely, hugely damaging and dangerous, and it's a slow erosion of an individual's safety and sense of self over a period of time, destroying their sense of self-worth.
Okay, so it's that starting point, and it's often the common thread that leads to homicide.
It does, yes.
And I think that's kind of like, that's the statement, you know, this is something that is serious, that if we don't get a handle on it, it can and has been proven to lead to murder and death.
Yes.
So
yes.
The New South Wales Parliament passed the Coercive Control Act in 2022, which from my understanding makes coercive control between a current or former intimate partner a criminal offence. So in doing so, New South Wales has actually become the first Australian state or territory to create a standalone offence for coercive control, which sounds really encouraging. But what does that actually mean for the general public? Like, you know, we kind of have all this lingo and, okay, you know, we've passed this act, but what does that mean for the average Joe?
And Tori, that is the exact question that needs answering. So yes, you know, we know when something's legislated, the law can send a really loud community message. From my perspective, CEO of Domestic Violence New South Wales, I want to see a lot of work done before we get to the point of it being a crime. 2024 is actually when coercive control will be a crime in New South Wales.
Right.
We know Tasmania, as a state, does criminalise coercive control. And we know Queensland is also doing some work to criminalise coercive control. As far as we're concerned at Domestic Violence New South Wales, it's actually the community engagement piece that's now really, really important. And I sit on the New South Wales Coercive Control Sector Reference Group. And funnily enough, we met yesterday. So we're talking about, okay, this is going to be a crime in 2024. And the bill was, the Act was passed in 2022, as you note, Tori. What do we need to do to make sure when it's a crime, we know what to do? So, and the community knows what to do. So first of all, the work that needs to be done is really around community awareness and campaigns. And being on your show is fantastic because we're having a conversation about what is coercive control outside of the domestic violence sector. I'm not sure many people know what coercive control is. So I really want to see some resources into the community. I want to see respectful education relationship work in schools. I want to ensure that victim survivors know what coercive control is, and when it becomes a crime, how will they know how to keep the evidence? You know, making sure that there's that conversation now happening with the services to say, because of course services are going to need to be supported with this too, because referrals may go up and should. We know how underreported domestic and family violence is, and gender-based violence is. So we want to make sure that victim survivors understand how to keep, you know, do they need to keep a diary, which happened in the UK when we legislated coercive control. We had to say as a service, make sure you've got a diary, that you're recording, screenshotting text messages, recording the abuse. Are you speaking to a professional? They could possibly provide you, they could provide a witness testimony. As I said, I want to see services funded adequately to be able to respond to the increase in referrals. So there's a really important work that needs to happen outside of the echo chamber, which can be our sector. You know, the conversations I'm having with you now, Tori, I really, really value, because we need to understand what this looks like and ensure that when victim survivors want to report, they've got the support and the understanding. And the community attitudes are really important here as well. And you know this as a passionate advocate, Tori. There is so much victim blaming headlines. What did she wear? Did she drink alcohol? All those types of things. We need to cut through these really poor community attitudes and make sure that our community is a safe place for victim survivors to report coercive control. And yes, it becomes a crime. That's a loud, loud message. But we've got to make sure police, the justice system, the courts, anyone responding is trauma informed and understands when someone reports domestic violence, they are believed, listened to, and supported appropriately. So there's a huge amount of work that needs to be done before we press go on that crime. And I'm really glad that I'm sitting on that reference group and that work is taking place and that is being prioritised, because the community engagement piece is the really important part.
It is. It's because, I mean, I'm a believer that it starts with education, right? If we're raising our children, our young boys and men, and our young girls and women in a way that they have an understanding of what is right and what is wrong, you know, it starts there. And being able to recognize coercive control, I think, you know, that's what I'm really hearing from you, is that people can understand what might actually be happening to them so that they can report it and kind of get to the root of the problem and understand how these things can start. So
absolutely.
From my understanding, there are sort of some pillars within coercive control, like financial abuse, reproductive abuse, spiritual abuse. Can we talk about those? Can we start with financial abuse? Because I think that's probably one of the most common issues that we're seeing. And something that perhaps, you know, a lot of women don't understand is actually a form of abuse. I think that we still have a little bit of a hangover from yesteryear where we as women are allowing our male counterparts to control family finances. Often women are in child-rearing roles.
Yes.
And they're not able to be in the community and be working, and so their access to money is controlled by their partner. Can you tell us what financial abuse can look like?
I absolutely can, and I really, really support flexible workplaces and workplaces that are really supporting mum and dads to be effective, because we only harm gender equity if we kind of keep pushing these kind of gender roles and men working, what have you. But financial abuse is a form of coercive control, and it can include withholding money, Controlling how the household spend is functioned, refusing to include the other party in financial decisions. And it can happen to anyone. I think we've got this view of, you know, a certain individual who might be affected by financial abuse. But our society encourages this power and control at times. So it can happen to anybody. And I think controlling access to money, preventing someone from having access to their own money, denying them from access to bank accounts or credit cards, or forcing them to hand over their income, and encouraging financial dependence. So, you know, if there is someone that's just earning the money, they control the banks, they control, you know, access to funds, and you know, it can even include sabotaging job prospects for a victim survivor who might be affected, and stopping them having access to education or job training. It can involve stealing or misuse of money, fraudulently taking out credit cards or loans in someone else's name, sabotaging the victim's credit. That's a big thing that we often see. So using money as a weapon to punish and control a victim. So there's quite a lot of elements to financial abuse, and we really do want to be talking more and more about this and making sure there is support around financial independence, and actually educating kids in school about financial independence and, you know, managing money, because I think those are things that possibly might get missed in the education system from time to time.
Absolutely. I mean, I think when we look at the domestic violence piece, people's minds go to battered women, right? And children who aren't safe in their homes. And obviously this is a huge problem. However, there are many, you know, there are many tentacles to this nasty beast, and financial abuse could completely ruin someone's life and completely deny them the ability to leave a situation, you know, whether it's violent or not, you know, and perhaps financial abuse is a precursor.
Absolutely. And this is the thing. I still go back to thinking about my time working in refuge when I picked up a woman who had been in an abusive relationship for 20 years and decided to pick up the phone and get help. We know it takes 8 to 10 times before someone can actually leave. And there's a lot more to that that we might discuss. But I picked her up and we made sure we could go shopping and get some food into the refuge for her. And I'll never forget watching her walk around with a trolley and just put literally a trolley full of bananas together, and I kind of looked twice, and again I was new in the space at the time and thought, what on earth is she doing? And it's because she'd never had independence to go shopping and never made decisions and wasn't supported to, and it was just kind of, let's put all the bananas in the trolley. And that might seem like, did she really do that? But yes, she did. She was again subject to coercive control for 20 years, did not know how to make decisions, and going into a shop was actually really overwhelming. How could she make a decision on what she was going to eat when it had been controlled for so long? So this is a really serious issue.
Massive. And reproductive abuse. I want to cover financial, reproductive and spiritual abuse, because I think that these are things that perhaps our audience don't know as much about.
Yes, and there are many forms of reproductive abuse. And again, I just want to add again to the listeners, this could be triggering. So again, make sure, you know, you've got 1-800-RESPECT online if you need it, and talk to a friend if this is impactful. But reproductive abuse can take many forms. It could be forcing or coercing reproductive choices, which could involve abortion, making someone continue their pregnancy against their will, or coercing someone to undergo sterilization. It could be sabotaging contraception, removing damage or damaging condoms, tampering with birth control pills, refusing to wear a condom during sex. So there's some really, really concerning forms of reproductive abuse. It could also involve forced pregnancy, forcing a victim to become pregnant, which could involve raping them without their consent. Or controlling access to reproductive healthcare, preventing a survivor from accessing healthcare, you know, withholding information about contraception or sexually transmitted infections, or preventing someone from seeking the medical treatment they deserve and are entitled to. So this is really impactful. And I have, again, in my time back in the UK, seen someone who's had a forced abortion, and it has been absolutely devastating and harmful and traumatic to that person. And you you know, you don't get through something like that ever. Mm. And you'll need constant support for life. So we do need to be having these very difficult conversations. And I'm really, again, welcoming of this chat right now, Tori.
I mean, this is the thing. It's, I feel like I'm repeating myself, but there are so many ways to be, in quotation marks, violent towards someone that may not actually involve physically hitting them, you know. So let's look at spiritual abuse. What can that entail?
So spiritual abuse can happen when someone uses, you know, religious beliefs or spiritual beliefs to hurt, scare, or control you. And it can involve forcing you or your children even to participate in practices that you simply don't want to. It could involve manipulating the victim's beliefs or twisting religious doctrine to control their behavior. It can involve isolating someone from their community, their family or support network, and again, using religion as a justification. It can involve withholding religion or spiritual resources from someone, access to prayer or services. And using language and, you know, to shame and blame the person. And it can involve using spiritual language or, you know, concepts to shame or blame someone in the context of sexual purity. And I've seen that again, you know, through work where someone thinks, oh, but I was told that this was in, you know, spiritual writings that, you know, I must do X, Y, Z. And it was really twisted on this person. There's, you know, some really, really concerning ways of how people can be forced into, you know, also practices, forcing a victim survivor to engage in practices that are against their will, such as maybe fasting or forcing them to pray or forcing them in other forms of worship. So again, it's all about power, control, and dominance. Really impactful.
That's what I was, this is how I'm sort of tying all of these things together. And I think it's, you know, it might seem really obvious to some people, but being able to define financial abuse, reproductive abuse, and spiritual abuse, and understand that all of those crimes fit under coercive control and are a way to intimidate and control and basically commit acts of violence, you know, towards someone. And I think that it's really important for us to know that there are many different ways that it can happen. And I think particularly for people like me, Delia, you know, I'm living in a very privileged bubble, and I think that, I hope that a lot of our listeners are as well. But that doesn't mean that we don't need to be savvy and we don't need to understand it, because if we want to be a part of a movement that creates change, then we need to understand what the fuck is going on. I was actually quite shocked. I had a midwife appointment recently, and one of the practices that they do, you know, our healthcare system is so fantastic. I go through the midwife group practice to have my babies. It's a public service. It's wonderful. And one of the things that they do very early on in the piece is they do ask you a lot of questions, a lot of personal questions, to ensure that you are safe and that you aren't living in a house that isn't safe, to ensure that you are mentally well. And, when they ran through this list of questions, it was eye-opening to me to be asked, does your partner make you feel safe? Has your partner ever threatened the pregnancy? All of these things. And my midwife actually made a point of telling me, and I said, oh, it's so wonderful to be asked this, because I know that there must be a lot of women out there who don't ever get the opportunity to even be asked. And perhaps
on their own.
Sitting alone at a midwife appointment might actually be their first opportunity to say, oh, actually, things aren't okay. And we sort of, you know, we got on a bit of a tangent, and my midwife said, well, you know, it's just so common in the eastern suburbs. And I thought, really, like, fucking hell, you know, like, I'm sorry for my friend, I'm definitely a swearer, but like, you know,
this deserves a fuck.
It does. And it's just, you know, people forget that there's so much that happens behind closed doors. And I guess my next question to you is, you know, how prevalent is this issue in our country? I mean, we started this conversation with that statistic of one woman a week is killed, but what are we seeing in New South Wales, Delia?
Yeah, I mean, the stats are absolutely horrendous, and I'm really pleased, you know, we work really closely with New South Wales Health, and those conversations that people are having, midwives are having with, pregnant women at just the start. We need to be having these conversations. We need to be making sure the midwives are connected with local services. So that's fantastic. That's happening. And we are in a bit of a bubble in terms of our attitude, Tori. We just had the National Community Attitude Survey released, and it is concerning. It means I've got a lot more work to do. My diary is going to get even more busier because there is so much that needs to be done in the community. We, you know, I can tell you that, you know, 91% of those respondents in this survey did agree that violence against women is a big problem in Australia. But 47%, which is nearly half, agreed it isn't a problem in their own suburb or town. Now, that's really, really concerning when you think about, you know, as you just said, we're losing one woman a week at the hands of a current or former partner, and one in three women. So, you know, there's two of us on this, you know, call right now. But, you know, if you think of it, if you're a room of 30 people, one in three women has experienced physical or sexual violence by a man they know. And one in four has experienced physical or sexual violence by a current or former partner. The police receive a phone call every 2 minutes, Tori. So just right now, you know, if we're on this podcast for an hour, that's 60 times, you know, that's 30 times that there's going to be a phone call to the police. A woman enters hospital every 3 hours with a domestic violence injury. And let's take it back to the kids. And this is how I got into this work. More than 1 million children right now in Australia are impacted by domestic and family violence. That's one in four children. And I need to see, you know, something I really advocate for, and something we advocate for at Domestic Violence New South Wales, is a response for children to be seen as victims in their own right and ensure there's services for them, because often children will blame themselves. So we do have a big, big issue in Australia, and it's certainly not outside of our suburb. You know, as I said, one in three women have experienced physical or sexual violence perpetrated by a man they know. So, you know, we're losing one woman a week. So I just need to be really explicit about that. And you know, sometimes we might not recognise we're impacted by domestic and family violence, and there's work to be done there too.
Yes. Yes. I mean, you know, I think in the bubble that I live in, and if I was to sit down with my friends, particularly the men in my life, the wonderful, wonderful men in my life, all of them, I'm sure, would 100% agree that domestic violence and coercive control, as you said, is an issue in our country. But I think that their view would be very similar to those numbers that you mentioned, where they don't think that it affects the people who are living next door, or who they work with, or who are maybe even in their friendship group. So, I mean, I've actually written this question down for later in the interview, but fuck it, let's go there now. I want to talk about men playing an active role in discussing men's violence against women. Like, how do you have any tips on how we can encourage men to be participants in this conversation? Because I feel like as women, you know, we could talk about this till the cows come home. It's really easy to sit down with a woman and talk about this, but to sit down with a man and not make them feel targeted, you know, which I think is really important. And that's why I sort of prefaced this by saying the wonderful men in my life. I mean, I am very, very privileged to have absolutely wonderful men in my life. And I'm really tired of this concept of, you know, me being a feminist, or, you know, me not taking my husband's name and all of this stuff, meaning that I don't really like men. I adore men, and I want them to be our allies, and I want them to be a part of this conversation. So any tips you have for us, including
yes,
them?
Yes, absolutely, Tori. And I think next stop is bringing men, so many more men, into the conversation. And I worked at White Ribbon, so, you know, I came from frontline organisations in the UK, worked in social work, worked in domestic violence. Came to White Ribbon in 2015, and it was all about engaging men positively in the solution. And I think it is about positive engagement and positive framing, because sometimes I'd speak to some men that were really key allies, and they'd say, look, we want to get involved, but often we're not invited to some of these events. So I think that's the thing, bringing men into the circle. And I think having some uncomfortable conversations, and that's about men looking inwardly as well about the privilege. And you know, we are moving forward, but I wonder if we looked around the meeting room table and we looked at who was the person that was popping the drinks on the table and who was doing the minutes. We've still got these gender rigid roles that we need to break, and we need to think about entitlement and privilege and all these different things, and have those conversations together safely without anyone feeling, you know, singled out. Let's all learn and grow together. Like, every day we're making mistakes, every day we're learning, and let's embrace it. But some of the things I would love, you know, to see, and again, I do work with some incredible allies in the space, and some of the things we believe that should be done in terms of encouraging men is about, you know, encouraging men to speak out and use their voice, you know, call out the sexism, call out the harmful attitudes. And we want to see much more education of men. So men going, oh, I didn't really know about the stats. Let me jump online and have a look at 1-800-RESPECT or, you know, go on this website and learn about the issue. There's always a debate about language, but, you know, I know some men in the space will call themselves pro-feminist because some people in the sector might say, well, you can't be a feminist because you're not, you know, you're not a woman.
Yes, but, you can. You
know, oh my God.
You can be, I know.
And why do we have to get so caught up on these stupid things that don't matter?
I'm so with you. And like I say, because this is where we need to be having these uncomfortable conversations and learning and growing together, because often what we might do is isolate men from the conversation by kind of getting into those types of things. But, you know, we want men to be allies. We want them to offer support, believe women's stories, you know, be supportive and stand beside and behind women in their journeys and, you know, their journeys of recovery, healing, you know, storytelling. We want to see the modeling of healthy relationships. You know, I'm the mother of a baby boy, and, you know, my partner's an incredible advocate in this space as well. And it's not about patting men on the back, but you know what? It's great to see some men that are modeling healthy, respectful relationships, and let's see more of that.
Yes.
And I mean, holding themselves to account, I think, is really important as well, where men can reflect like we do, you know, as women. And certainly, like, I think I know I make mistakes every day, and I'm learning and I'm growing, and I want to be part of a safe conversation to make a difference in Australia. So let's ensure that men too are part of that conversation and hold themselves accountable and listen, learn and reflect on their own attitudes and go, oh my gosh, I had no idea. I had this unconscious bias, and I always just assumed women did X, Y, Z. And let's just, again, encourage a safe environment where those conversations can happen. Because if we don't, this is where we've got the isolation, and then we get the blame culture and the really hating voices that I've definitely seen all over social media.
And that's not helpful. I'd love to see.
Yeah, absolutely not helpful. And you end up with those kind of really scary groups that are kind of starting to bring young people into the conversation, like the Andrew Tates. And I think that is a conversation we need to be having. How is Andrew Tate engaging men and boys? And we need to think about, why is he so attractive, and start getting into that fast, because that is a real concern for us right now in terms of that he is no role model. We know that, but he's engaging, and we need to get amongst that and have those conversations and get into the schools and find out, again, you know, what we can do to make sure those harmful podcasts, you know, are confronted. And that's about mentoring young men. So really making sure those allies we spoke about are mentoring young people and having conversations with them. We want to see men supporting domestic violence organisations, you know, going on the marches, volunteering, donating, advocating, and generally being, you know, playing an active role in the discussion and not shying away from it. Because I think if we're not working together, we're not creating that safe and more equitable world that we really want to see. So there's such a place for men in the conversation. And I think, as we've said, Tori, we're both clearly passionate in the same way that we don't want to isolate men from the conversation. So the conversation needs to be safe, and it is about learning and growing, but we do need to see accountability as well.
Yes, I think that's the thing. And I think it's about, you know, when I look at, okay, well, what can I do? What can Tori do in her home? And, you know, one thing that I'm really proud to say is that this is actually a topic of conversation that my husband and I do cover. Like, he knows that I really want for him to play a role in these conversations. I don't want to just sit around with my girlfriends and talk about this stuff. This isn't women's issues. This is a societal issue. And so I think that, you know, for any listeners out there who are wanting to take small steps, like perhaps just sitting down with your partner and actually talking about these issues is an amazing place to start.
I love that. Absolutely.
And encouraging your partner to perhaps, you know, like you said before, perhaps finding ways to encourage their friendship groups to maybe sort of take some responsibility around language and around, like, these sort of things that are sort of insidious, but they creep in. They creep into our perception of women and the way that we treat each other. So, you know, one thing that my husband has said, and he'll probably kill me for saying this, but he has said that he's noticed over the years that his group chat, you know, every man's got a group chat, has really changed. And the way that his friends discuss women and talk about women has really changed. And I think that that's really cool, you know, like that they are becoming self-aware. And I really encourage my husband when he notes something about gender equality, I encourage him to talk to me about it more, because I think the more we can play an active role in these conversations, the better. Like, for example, my husband said the other day, he was jumping on a franchise call with someone who potentially might want to open a Peaches studio. And he said, it's the woman's business. And she will be the face of the studio and you know, it's really all about her. But he said, I can't help but notice that their husbands or their partners or their fathers are always on these calls. And he said, I just don't think that it would be like that if it was flipped. If a man was going to start a business, would he say, oh, I'll get my wife on the phone with me, or I'll ask my mother to jump on the line?
Yes. You know?
And it's such a small thing. And I kind of actually, I remember when he said this to me, I almost dismissed it. And I said, well, this might be a family decision, you know, like this might be like it's both of their money, and perhaps her partner's actually going to play an active role in supporting her, or perhaps, you know, X, Y, Z. But actually, like, it was really cool that Chris took the time to recognize that and say that. And it sounds silly, but this is where it starts. Like, this is where we can start to make change, just picking up on these little things that
exactly.
are so often brushed over, you know?
Yes, definitely. And I think, you know, sometimes when I'm doing speeches on the circuit, you know, I'll often say, do we need to look inwardly? You know, and so that, you know, again, it's about us being in this together, because we're all conditioned by what we read, see and hear. And I always go back to thinking about being a kid, you know, supporting Tottenham Hotspur, still do, for my sins. If anyone follows the football, we had a really bad loss at the weekend. but anyway, moving on. But I never saw the women playing, because in the papers in the UK, it was always the men playing football. It was always the money that was invested into men's football back in soccer in the UK. And it's only now, I mean, it's incredible to see, you know, how far we've come. But I didn't even think about it probably as a teenager. It wouldn't have been, I was going off to Tottenham Hotspur to watch the men play. I wouldn't have even thought about the women playing. And again, I cringe and I think about it, but it was kind of the conditioning of what the media fed me and what I thought, you know, was football. Yep. So yeah, we've really got to reflect on these things and just have these conversations out loud and go, wow, we're all on a journey and we are really conditioned by the media. So there's a huge amount of work we need to be doing with the media and do so. I spoke with another podcast a couple of weeks ago, funnily enough, and they were talking a bit about what role can the media play. And they play such an important role around language and accountability. So yeah, lots to do.
And just these preconceived ideas, you know, like you've touched on media and how we're influenced, but we are so influenced by family and by our friendship groups as well. Like even something as simple as, you know, when we got married, I didn't change my last name. And when we had our daughter, it was a discussion. It was a topic that was, first of all, up for fucking discussion about whose name my daughter would take on. And even that I appreciated. What I wanted was to just have the conversation. I didn't want to assume whose name she would take, because that's not helping if I just assume she's going to take my name, which she did, by the way. But I just wanted – I wanted to have an open and honest conversation. But I remember when we got married 5 years ago, I was chatting to one of my friends, a male friend who's such a legend, and we sort of broached the subject of the fact that I wasn't taking Chris's name, and he was genuinely really, really shocked, and he said, "Well, what do you mean? Like, but how's that going to work?" And I said, "Well, would you have taken your wife's name?" And he was like, "Well, no." I said, "Well." therein lies my answer. Like, why would you just assume that I would take my husband's name? And it's these little things that actually do start to
feed into power.
Yes.
Yeah, yes. Absolutely. Because they start from a place of power. And that's this, you know, the systems and structures that lend themselves to the inequality are these types of things that happened back in the day. And funnily enough, I'm engaged, but my son has both our surnames. And we've agreed when we get married that it will be my surname and my partner's second. We'll share each other's. So he'll have my actual surname and then his after. Mm. So yeah, it's just, we're moving forward and having some great conversations about it, but it's like, it's back in the day of power and control.
And I think, like, I don't want this to be like a pissing competition where I'm like, well, guess what? I didn't take my husband's name. And aren't we cool and aren't we forward? It's not about that. It's about me saying, I don't care what the result is. What I care about is that it was up for discussion and that your partner or your male counterpart was actually willing to discuss it without getting defensive and without getting frustrated and annoyed and thinking that you're being ridiculous. Because I think that's where it goes. I mean, at the end of the day, pick the name that sounds the best, or pick the name that goes best with the first name. Like, let's make practical decisions. Let's not make decisions based on freaking
Donovan rocks, okay?
It's, oh my God, I love the last name Donovan. Okay, we're getting a little sidetracked here. I want to ask you, particularly for our listeners, what are some signs that we can look out for that may indicate that someone is suffering from some sort of domestic violence or coercive control? Because I think, you know, we're very aware, particularly after you covered things like financial, reproductive and spiritual abuse, that these things can slip in ways that we wouldn't have originally, you know, thought of.
Yeah, and I mean, over time as well, when we think about coercive control. So I think with kind of recognizing signs that someone might be affected, I think we need to think about changes in their behavior. But then I'd also add that, unfortunately, when you have been exposed to gender-based violence for such a long time, you may be able to hide the abuse from others. So yes. I think here is what I'd say is, you know, if you're worried about a friend, just being supportive, non-judgmental and having an open dialogue is going to be really essential. And I mean, if we're thinking about actual indicators to monitor, but noting, I have said, people will hide the abuse because simply they are so impacted and harmed and, you know, self-worth and everything else been, you know, just eaten away at. But there are some indicators that people could look out for. And, you know, as you said, we're not talking so much about physical, but someone might have unexplained injuries. And that might be something that you could check in with a friend on. Emotional changes, you know, if someone's exposed to gender-based violence, they could be showing, you know, anxiety, they could be withdrawn, depressed. You might notice that a friend's acting, you know, is more isolated. They've suddenly moved away. That was a shock, you know, or, you know, they're just generally not coming to lots of activities anymore. And, you know, if we think about an abuser's attempt to control the victim survivor, you know, really thinking about their access to finance and transportation, you know, and getting them to reflect again about, you know, what they're wearing, what they're eating. And some of those things they might start dropping. Oh, he doesn't like me eating that. Or, yeah, no, I'm wearing that because he really likes that outfit. And just starting to think about what control can look like in someone's behavior. So, you know, it's there are quite a few indicators, and people do tend to get cut off from their friends. And unfortunately, I've seen it so many times where friends start getting judgmental and getting fed up. Oh, you know, they're not going to listen. Oh, we've tried. Okay, we're going to intervene. We're going to do X, Y, Z. And it's about, hang on, let's just slow down and let's just be present. Let's be unconditional and let's be non-judgmental and be there for our friend and be ready for them to disclose to us or be ready when they say, I'm ready to leave.
Yes. Yes. Okay. That's really, really helpful. What about even things like the phone, Delia? I've actually had a few friends over the years, and that's been the first indication to me that something might not be kosher was their partner calling them incessantly, texting them when they're with their friends. You know, my friend being really nervous to answer the phone and leaving the room to talk to their partner and constantly providing updates on where they are and when they'll be home. I think this kind of monitoring is definitely a warning sign, kind of like being checked in on. And I guess...
Absolutely. Like, yeah, stalking and harassment, yes, no less.
Yes, yes, you're right. But it's very difficult when you're in that moment to know how to address it, and to address it in a way that's actually going to be helpful and not make the person feel more isolated or more guilty or more shame-ridden. And I think at the time we said to this particular friend, like, gosh, he's checking in on you a lot. Like, are you okay? Which kind of leads to my next question, which is, what can we do? Like, what is the best way to broach this subject? Because like you've said, you know, we do need to approach it very, very tenderly to not further isolate the women and not make them feel further isolated or ashamed. Are there like a few things that you think are particularly helpful when we originally bring it up with someone?
Yeah, I think sometimes if an individual's with a lot of friends, the last thing we want is pack mentality, that it's kind of like, oh, you're all against me and I'm just feeling really overwhelmed. Just let me, you know, deal with this myself. This is my relationship. But I think, again, I'm just going to go back to being that unconditional, non-judgmental friend. It is effective. It does work. And recognizing, you know, it can take up to 10 times to leave an abusive relationship. And people think, oh my gosh, like that, what? You know, how does it take that long? But it actually does. And people will try and leave so many times. And, you know, people, it's not straightforward in leaving as well. You've got children, you've got network, you're coerced, your self-esteem, you know, the financial control, all the things we've discussed would make it so difficult to leave an abusive relationship. And not to mention, it's such a dangerous time as well, I should add, when someone is leaving an abusive relationship. But certainly providing a really supportive function as a friend, an open dialogue where you listen and believe your friend, that's the main thing to do. I think seeing them go off and use their phone and be anxious isn't great, and saying, hey, you're okay, we're worried about you, or, you know, and trying not to be patronizing, it's so hard, and everyone knows their individual friend better than anyone else. But, you know,
privacy,
concern.
I think, like you said, like avoiding doing it in a big group, taking the time to do it privately and quietly.
Exactly. And saying, you know, I've noticed you're not seeming yourself at the moment. Are you okay? And calling it out, but expressing concern and love and being unconditional. And yourself, you know, thinking about where are the local services, where are the resources, so that you've got that information for your friend if they want it. And we mentioned again about, you know, being patient, because I think, again, I've noted, you know, noted how many times it can take to leave an abusive relationship. But being patient is so important, because we're so close with our best friends that we instantly maybe don't have the boundaries that we should sometimes. So it's like, be patient, don't judge, be there, and just let your friend know that you are unconditionally there if they need you. And your friend might eventually reach out and say they want to leave. And then it's about safety planning. And you can go online and get some really cool safety plan templates. And again, you know, making sure that they might need a safe place to stay. Is it your house? Have they got a bag packed? Have they got their passports and ID and those things in safe places? Because I know certainly when people are wanting to leave, they do need ID. But not to say that's the be all and end all. If you know, your safety is the first thing that comes first. But ultimately, again, it's about respecting your friend's decisions and supporting them to make informed decisions. They've been through enough power and control. The last thing they need is you telling them how to do this, how to do that. So I think it's very much about being present, listening, believing, expressing concern, making sure you know resources. And I think for those friends that are really worried, making sure that you take care of yourself too, because it is quite tough when you're watching someone go through something really, really hard, like domestic and family violence, gender-based violence. So really think about the support you might need. And 1-800-RESPECT does also offer support to those that are worried about someone impacted by domestic violence.
That's really important. I think one of the things that perhaps people like me are going to come across is maybe seeing some of these earlier warning signs and red flags and not knowing how to address them before it becomes something more sinister. I think that's where a lot of us are going to struggle, where we can see that there's an unhealthy dynamic and you don't know where it's going to go, but you have concerns. And I think, you know, what you've said there is really helpful, like about creating a safe, non-judgmental, patient space where you allow someone to come to you over time. Because I think, and you know, I talked about this actually with in terms of alcohol. I did a recording recently with my friend Maz Compton, who's gone sober, and you know, I said to her, there's a lot of people who are going to say, well, this doesn't apply to me because I'm not passing out on a Wednesday night with a bottle of wine in my bed. But what I kind of want to talk about is the smaller things. And it's the same here where I might not have a friend who needs to have a bag packed and who needs to go to a shelter. Like, she's not at that stage yet. But in fact, she is in a relationship that's very unhealthy in other ways, in more tricky ways, in more sly ways, in more secret ways, and ways that perhaps her partner may not even realize aren't okay. And I guess this all comes back to having the conversation and educating ourselves around coercive control and the types of ways that partners can try to control.
Absolutely. And I think, Tori, you know, we shouldn't all feel alone in this journey, because there is a huge amount of work that needs to be done when we speak about, you know, criminalizing coercive control. And we spoke about that community engagement. I think workplaces play a really important role now. And we've got 10 days domestic and family violence leave that was legislated in February. So workplaces have to provide domestic violence leave now, which means they have to think about their response in the workplace to perpetrators and to victim survivors. Mm. We want to get into schools. We want to get into sporting codes. We want to look at those campaigns, those awareness campaigns in the community. It's basically a whole of community approach that's needed so that those conversations are less hard when we know that, oh, there's an advert on TV and it says this is what coercive control looks like. And I go into some pub, go into the toilet, and there's a poster on the back of the door around where you can get help and support. Yes. For men using violence and for women who need help. So we just need to really think about that public awareness raising piece, and these conversations will start flowing a lot easier. So it's tough when you feel like, gosh, I've got to do this on my own, but there's a big piece of work that is being planned by the government, and I think it's absolutely paramount, and I do think this is long-term work.
It is, and it's about changing our approach. And I think it can be difficult, particularly as a feminist, as someone who gives a shit, as someone who's trying to be proactive, to not feel like you're constantly whistleblowing and bringing up issues. But I think at the end of the day, if we can start early and say, well, no, hold on, this behavior isn't okay, then it doesn't eventuate into physical violence. You know, like, I think we've come such a long way in so many avenues in terms of, like, respect for women in the workplace. And, you know, we talk about, like, workplace sexual misconduct and stuff like that. Like, it actually starts by calling out people when they bring up how you look or what you're wearing to work. And it's the same thing with domestic violence. Okay, someone isn't rocking up with a black eye. However, they're coming to us and saying, oh, well, I don't have access to money, or, oh, my partner really wants me to get an abortion, but I don't, or my partner really wants me to have a baby, but I'm absolutely not ready. Like, we need to cover these conversations, which are, you know, probably much more common and much more everyday, but are leading to the bigger societal issues. I don't know if
yes,
I
definitely. And
that
I
right.
want to. No, Tori, you're on the money, and I want to swear now because I'm getting passionate, but I also want to add to that and say that we need to give a shit, and that's half the issue. That, yes, oh, it's over there, it's not on my door. And it's not just even about your friends, it's about giving a damn about people and humans, and knowing that one woman a week is murdered. And actually, it's going to take all of us to give a shit, to be frank.
Yes.
So it's not just, you know, oh, I'll keep an eye if it's my friend, or I'll keep an eye if it's over here, but it's like, let's care about society, not murdering women.
Yeah. Yep. So, so true. Oh, it's just such a big subject, and it's multifaceted. Like, okay, we need to look at what we can do in our friendship groups and in our conversations with our partners and the men in our lives. And then it's also, okay, but also still over there, someone's been murdered this week. There's two sides to this coin. Can we talk about, before I know you have to go because you're the busiest woman ever, and before I actually ask you some personal questions, because I think it's really nice for us to learn more about the Delia Donovan who isn't just media facing and the CEO of Domestic Violence New South Wales. Like, you know, you're still a woman who's got a little baby boy Hunter at home and her own things going on. But I just want to talk quickly about perpetrators.
Yes.
And we've sort of half covered this, but perhaps particularly, you know, maybe for our male listeners out there, what are some common factors or traits that we can look out for as red flags, you know, perhaps maybe in the language that they use when they talk about women or their partners or things like that? Because I think that it's important for us to go, okay, here are some red flags for, you know, when someone might be suffering from abuse, but what about red flags for the person who's actually fucking doing it?
Absolutely. And I think that's about kind of looking inwardly at your behaviour. And if you need to get help, please take it. And there is the men's referral line and men's line. And we might add that to the content, Tori, yes, after the podcast. But it's really thinking about the control that you might be showing towards someone and the power and the dominance. And possibly, are you using threatening language? Are you limiting access to, as we said, you know, finances and necessities and things that, you know, your partner might want? Are you stalking and monitoring your partner? Are you looking at their phone, wanting to know where they are, putting a deadline on when they return, asking them to wear this or eat that or lose weight or, you know, what have you? Are you forcing your partner to do things possibly sexually that they don't want to do? Are you putting your partner down, humiliating them, which we know, obviously, we said around, you know, the self-worth and self-esteem impacts that can have. We spoke about financial abuse, you know, really thinking about, oh, hang on, I am the one that has the credit card and I do say when we go here and eat here and pay that bill, what have you. And, you know, and also children, we need to bring children into this conversation because children, it is shocking how children are used through the family law court system. Don't get me started. But really thinking again about how kids are used in, you know, domestic and family violence. And it is really, really concerning. And the impact that has on their emotional well-being. And we mentioned, you know, about the spiritual abuse. You know, someone stopping you from practicing religion or forcing you to practice certain religions. And generally, is someone making you feel scared? Because guess what? Feeling scared is not okay and it's not healthy. Yes. So those are some of those red flags, I think, that we need to be thinking about. If you're making someone feel scared, we're speaking obviously to people that are using violence, but are you dominating, using power, control and fear to exert power and control, I should say. So yeah, there's definitely quite a lot of red flags that we would want people to start reflecting about.
And I think, like you said, you hit the nail on the head. It is actually about having the discipline to self-reflect and look at your behavior. And perhaps, you know, ask yourself, would you be happy if the roles were reversed? I think that's the big piece, right? You know, and that
definitely
can come to so many things.
Oh, yeah, nail on the head. I think that's a good one.
I feel like we this is the tip of the iceberg, this conversation.
Isn't it?
At least we've started, and at least, you know, like, we might be stirring that pot and encouraging, you know, those listening to either have a conversation with the people in their lives just to make it part of conversation. Maybe they've recognized that actually someone in their life might be controlling them, or that they are themselves being quite controlling. I'm so grateful for you to take the time to start this conversation with our community. And now I'm going to completely flip this on its head and just talk to you as the woman. And I don't know, it must be quite nice for you to be asked questions that aren't all about legislation and all of this stuff. But you as a human, Delia, let's go there.
I'm all over me as a human. Let's do it.
Well, you recently became a mummy. Congratulations. Hunter's 14
months
old.
Thank you so much. Yeah, 14 months old.
What do you love most about motherhood?
Do you know, interestingly, I think my favourite part of motherhood at the moment, because the job is so busy, is the daycare pickup. Going into daycare and seeing his face is something else. So I'm loving being a mum. I'm loving spending time with this cute little human who looks at the world so attentively. And I just love that pickup and that playtime that we get together. So it's an honour to be his mum, actually, and learning and growing as a woman myself by being a mum.
Yes. Beautiful. What has been your proudest moment in your motherhood journey?
I was thinking about this one, Tori, and I think my most proudest moment is probably giving birth. And I think it was probably the most traumatic and beautiful experience all at once. So very, very proud of those several days in hospital and producing a beautiful baby.
You did it. You brought a human into this world. I love indeed, that. Yeah. I was really hoping you'd say birth, because it's a big one, and it's obviously top of my mind at the moment.
I can only imagine.
I'm on the cusp. I'm like, when's it happening? I actually thought I might be going into labor last night.
Or even now, that would be fun for the listeners.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, imagine if my waters just broke. So outside of motherhood, and maybe we should even take this outside of your career, although of course it can be a career thing, because you, I mean, my God, in my eyes, you have a million things that you could be most proud of. But outside of motherhood, in your personal life or your career life, what are you really proud of?
I think I will bring it back to career to some extent. And I think it was basically going into a refuge organization as a social work student, having managed children's homes, and thought, wow, this is a great organization, but we're not doing anything with the kids. And then being invited back to set up their children's services department and getting an award a year later. So really looking at the response, how domestic and family violence impacts children and young people, and making sure there was therapeutic one-to-one, there was play therapy, there was group work, there was work with mums about how they parented, and just really doing that work around children and young people. That's my true inspiration and my proud moment. Wow. I'm really pleased to see that work continues back in the UK in that wonderful organisation I'm an ambassador for.
That's incredible. That is so incredible.
Thank you.
What about... This feels so funny to ask you these questions when we've had such a big episode, but this is the Peaches podcast. Delia.
And we need to download and debrief and just bring it down a notch. Yeah, no, it's all good.
When do you feel sexiest?
I love this question, Tori. I think it's after a hair wash, to be honest.
Oh, yeah, that's a biggie.
Yes.
Nailed it. Okay, and when do you feel least sexy?
And I've been really cheeky here, and I'm thinking I feel least sexy when I need a hair wash.
Okay. All right. You got the easy way out. But I mean, greasy, dank hair. I get it. You're not really in the mood. Hair is such a big thing, isn't it? Can I just say that?
Isn't it?
It really, I feel like if I'm having a good hair day, I look good and I can have like a really nice outfit, cute makeup. But if the hair is not there, it's, you know, it really, it's a big one.
Completely, completely. And I think I don't even feel like I need much makeup when the hair is bouncy. So, you know, yeah, it's a good moment in my life when it's washed, but not when it's not.
Sometimes it's nice to just take things down a notch and be a little bit superficial. Okay, what is in your fridge every week that you buy without fail? Like your household doesn't function unless this is in the fridge.
Well, my partner really jokes about this when we first got together. We've been together just over 5 years and he would answer this for me and I'll answer it anyway. But it's tomatoes and blueberries are essentials, absolute essentials in every shop. And even when I don't need them, I pop to the shops to add them to my basket.
you're just making sure they're ever present.
Exactly. Who doesn't need tomatoes and blueberries in their life?
Oh my God, the blueberry thing with the child. I just wasn't prepared for how much money we were going to spend on berries, actually, having a child.
Well, now that's a real reason to have it in the fridge completely, the punnets. And the raspberries are a big one at the moment for us.
Oh my God, same.
Yeah.
Izzy demolishes them. Yeah, crazy. And I'm like, dude, that was $7 and it's gone.
It is not cheap. We try to go down the frozen route and it's just not the same at all.
No. And they know, the cheeky little buggers, they really know.
Yeah.
What's your death row meal, speaking of food?
I really had to think about this. I mean, chocolate's a big thing for me, but I think I'd go for a Chinese, and I'm thinking a chicken chow mein, please, for death row.
That's really British of you. Do you know, it's like we don't eat as much Chinese food over here. It's not as big of
a thing.
It's
so British.
Okay. I feel like I need to – I can't even picture a chow mein. Is it noodles?
Noodles, chicken, and I'm all over that, and a bit of sweet and sour sauce if
like
it's
cabbage
going.
Is that kind of the vibe, like a bit of like shredded
it's
cabbage
not or? But it could be, but I mean Chinese in general, I mean it's really funny because here we don't really get a lot of Chinese either, we don't really get those takeaways, but back in the day in the UK it was always a Chinese and a chicken chow mein. Okay. Without doubt.
I'm gonna Google it. I'm gonna maybe try making one.
I might send you some images, actually, some really naughty Chineses.
Please do. Okay, final question, because I know you have to run. This is the OG Peaches podcast question. We used to actually start our interviews with this. I want to know what your pet peeve is. What is the thing that just fucking gets you every time, whether it's your partner who does it, or someone at work, or someone on the street. Like, what is it that you're like, I know that this isn't a big deal, but I can't handle this?
I am so funny with food, and I think it's people that eat with their mouth open. And even as a kid, for some reason, what a funny little rascal I was, I used to actually feel quite sick if people did that as a child. And now I'm an adult and I'm, you know, come on now.
You're disgusted by it.
It's still pretty big. So yeah, that would be the one thing. It wouldn't be kind of slow walkers or anything like that. It's pretty much people opening their mouth when they're eating, or certainly, you know, we all do that, of course, but when food starts flying, it's a little bit.
Is gross. That is really gross.
Indeed.
Oh my gosh.
Get a napkin.
Well, so nice to hear a little bit more about the woman behind the role, because, you know, at the end of the day, I have so much respect for the life that you're living right now and how demanding your work and your schedule is. And it's important for us to remember that, you know, people working in government and people out there in the media, you know, you're also the woman who goes home, who needs her bloody tomatoes and her blueberries, and who hates it when people talk with their mouth open.
Excuse me.
I think we need to humanize, you know, at the public figures in our lives, and realize how hard they are working behind the scenes.
Definitely.
So definitely. Thank you.
And managing those daycare runs.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Tori. I mean, honestly, it's a privilege to do the work I do. And it's also wonderful to have conversations with you and just get some of these conversations more into the mainstream. So, yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
Oh my gosh, it was my absolute privilege. Guys, thank you for tuning in. Thank you for hitting play on today's episode. I know that it was a biggie. In the show notes, we will be including all of the details for 1-800-RESPECT, and also for men, as Delia mentioned, for any men who might be seeking help. We will provide all of those resources for you. Please don't be afraid to reach out to anyone if this conversation was triggering to you. And I'll be talking to you very soon. Thank you again, Delia.
Pleasure. Thank you so much, Tori. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.